Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. More than 50 years ago, just the idea of plastics was novel. The 1967 film The Graduate highlighted the industry as the future in a famous scene with the star Dustin Hoffman, who played the newly minted college graduate Ben at his graduation party. He's getting the usual questions about his future and some timely advice.
What are you going to do now?
I was going to go upstairs for a minute.
Oh, I meant with your future.
Your life.
Well, that's a little hard to say.
Ben.
Excuse me. Mr. McGuire.
Ben.
Mr. McGuire.
Come with me for a minute. I want to talk to you. Excuse us, Joanne.
Of course. Excuse.
Thank you.
Congratulations.
Just wonderful.
I look at him and I can't believe it.
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, I am.
Plastics.
The future of plastics plays large again in a region currently known for its shale gas resources and known as the Shale Crescent, which includes portions of West Virginia, Pennsylvania, and Ohio. Long known as the Rust Belt, the region could be rejuvenated with hundreds, if not thousands, of jobs in an industry closely linked with natural gas, the petrochemical industry. Journalist Ken Silverstein is covering the energy sector and has been following the issue for Forbes. He joins us by phone. Welcome to the show, Ken.
Hi, Ann. Thanks for having me.
You wrote back in March that the emergence of shale gas has the potential to help liberate the region. What do you mean by that?
Well, I'm from West Virginia, and West Virginia is coal dependent, and the future of coal, of course, is pretty dim. But at the same time, West Virginia, Ohio, West Virginia sits on the Marcellus Shale, and Ohio on the Utica Shale Basin, and this is really the land of opportunity in terms of the amount of natural gas that could come out of there. And it's not just the dry natural gas that's used for electric generation, but the so-called wet natural gas that goes into things such as plastics that you just described, actually a whole host of consumer products. And that has to be harnessed and manufactured somewhere. So
why not
there? It provides a lot of opportunity, yeah.
I read an interesting piece that talked about how that region always has sort of been at the mercy of its natural resources, that it's a kind of a situation where it's resource rich, but infrastructure poor, educationally poor, the coal industry never invested in the region in terms of growing it and developing it beyond just the raw materials that it took from it.
Oh, and you really hit on the ultimate paradox. I mean, it's both a blessing and a curse. The amount of natural resources that lay beneath the Earth's surface in our region is just enormous. But, the allegations, of course, are that these out-of-state energy companies, they come and they extract these resources and they leave the land marred. And once they leave, it's just sort of a barren place with no possibility. And there are great minds that are trying to resolve that dilemma. But I guess the other side of the coin is that if your main source of income has dried up and all of a sudden you're presented with this new opportunity, there's all this shale gas beneath your land, The objective, of course, is to extract those resources in a way that doesn't leave the people destitute once it's dried up.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a good question. We're talking about the future of the Ohio Pennsylvania and West Virginia region, known as the Shale Crescent right now, also known as the Rust Belt. And maybe future in the future will be known as the Plastics Belt. My guest is Ken Silverstein. He's been he's a journalist. He's been covering the global energy business and writes about this region for Forbes as a contributor. We'll have a link to his story on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. We're talking about what that future holds for people. So, Ken, is this different than the coal industry? Well, all right. So the shale industry, people have leased their lands for the shale, the fracking and the mining of this natural resource. And the boom for people it's been kind of uneven. If you have a lot of property and you've been able to do good on your leasing contracts, you know, there've been some overnight millionaires, but the burden of that industry has been borne by everybody in the region, including most people who have not personally benefited. Does the plastics business hold something different?
The president of Dow Chemical said that, let me reverse myself for just a second. It used to be that companies would ask themselves what their China policy would be, because China was where most of these companies developed their business plans. But now with the abundance of shale gas resources, you know, it's shifted to this country. Now you've got these American companies, chemical companies like Dow, DuPont, and you know all of the wet natural gas, the butane, the methane, so forth that you can crack from the dry natural gas in order to create these chemicals are right here, and they go into a whole host of consumer products. That are too long to list on your show. And so the amount of money that companies save by being able to be based here, the amount of money that goes into communities that's reinvested, there are literally hundreds of new chemical plants that are being started. That's a lot of investment. That's a lot of jobs. That's a lot of opportunity. By the same token, it's a lot of pollution, you know, a lot of carbon emissions. And so there's a balance between the economic opportunity and the, and the environmental degradation. And of course, that's what we have to balance as a society.
Is the regulatory mechanisms, are they in place to protect the people in these regions from the potential pollution?
It depends on who you ask. Okay, if you were a chemical company or a natural gas driller, you would say that the states have their own regulations and that the federal government should stay out of it because the states are closer to the actual development at hand. The problem with that thinking, Anne, is that I guess the polite way of saying it is that, you know, they all know each other. You know, the developers and the regulators and the legislators, they have very cozy relationships with each other. And so the concern, of course, is there's this revolving door between and among all the different parties. And so, you know, the regulation is a little impure, if that's the right word. Whereas if it's federally regulated, it's a little bit more sound. There's less sort of, closeness. So on a federal level, you know, they want to talk about, you know, the concoctions that go into the development, the chemicals that are used to frack the gas out of the ground. Where on the state level, they often don't require that. So if you're an environmentalist, you would say that the regulations need to be a lot stricter. If you're a developer, you would say the states are doing a fine job.
We're going to be talking to an environmentalist coming up on the program later on. But is the expectation, Ken Silverstein, that that 30-year-old industry that's been built up, that hub from the Gulf, will move? Or is this going to be an expansion of the petrochemical industry in the United States?
That's a great question. I tend to think that the Gulf Coast will always dominate in this particular sphere of the economy. It's more established. The regulatory environment down there is established, and it's friendlier to developers, to chemical companies. And I don't see companies moving to our region. Having said that, the amount of shale gas in our region is just enormous. So companies could locate there, and if the infrastructure could get built, it would be closer to where the natural gas would be consumed. So there is a lot of opportunity, but I would not look to our region to supplant with the Gulf Coast, the traditional role that the Gulf Coast has played.
The advantages of this region obviously begins with the natural resources, the dry and the wet natural gas. But it's also a logistical dream for transportation, the people who have to deal with the transportation issue. And there's access to a Great Lake, right?
The infrastructure, Anne, is not easy to get built.
Okay, so that's the downside, yeah.
It's infrastructure. I mean, if you look at whether it's transmission wires or natural gas pipelines, it is a nightmare to get built. Takes years. That's primarily that's the key obstacle here to development of the region.
Do you think the petrochemical businesses expecting, tax rebates or tax abatements and that kind of a thing that businesses are usually, attracted with, or is the, the natural resource itself impetus enough?
Oh, that's another great question. I can answer that with an anecdote. In West Virginia, I think West Virginia has a $75 billion economy, and there is a Chinese chemical company that is looking to invest $80 billion, in other words, greater than the size of the West Virginia economy, over the next 20 years. And so what West Virginia offers, as well as Ohio and the other states in the area, is access to that natural gas, so that company has an option to go to Ohio, West Virginia, Pennsylvania, and these companies are going to be laying out the red carpet. These states are going to be laying out the red carpet for this company. So they do give away a lot, but at the same time, they got the natural gas there.
Right. You know? So that's the big carrot.
They compete. They compete. These states compete with each other for that.
Any sense yet in your reporting about which state is best positioned to attract the most and the best jobs? Be honest.
I mean, Pennsylvania's done a great job.
Yeah.
Attracting these industries. Ohio is, I think, home to most of these chemical companies. West Virginia's throwing its hat in the ring. It's these economic developers are bidding for these businesses to come in. It's jobs, it's economic wealth, it's opportunity for people to stay in these states rather than to migrate to bigger cities where, you know, other jobs are located. There's a new hope. And the thing about it, Ann, is that I've been covering this industry for more than 20 years.
Uh-huh.
And there was a time when, you know, natural gas was just, I mean, it just kind of came out of nowhere to become this fuel of the future.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not just talking about, you know, the wet natural gas that goes into these chemical enterprises. We're talking about dry natural gas that's used for electric generation. So it just sort of materialized in the last decade and created all this opportunity. So it's still a bit of musical chairs, and we don't know, you know, who's going to get a seat, who's going to get left out. But your original question, which is, you know, what happens when, you know, when it all dries up and these developers decide to, you know, take their monies and go back to wherever they came from.
Mm-hmm.
That's a great question. And again, if you look at these coal counties in West Virginia, I mean, they're really hurting right now because there's no investment there. And it's all kind of dried up and left. So you want to avoid that in the long run. And that's what, you know, hopefully our policymakers are thinking about, you know, rather than how to extract it right now and take advantage of it. I mean, they need to take a longer view.
Ken Silverstein, thanks for joining us today. I really appreciate your time.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Ken Silverstein is a Forbes contributor. He's been covering the global energy business, and in particular, the shale crescent of West Virginia, Ohio, and Pennsylvania, where there's been the boom in the shale natural gas production. We'll continue our conversation about what this means for the shale crescent that could be turned into a plastics belt. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Natural gas production in portions of Ohio, Pennsylvania, and West Virginia this year exceeded total production in Texas. The bounty has attracted the attention of the petrochemical industry, which creates the materials for plastics. We're talking about what that could mean for the region. Joining us is Cheryl Johncox of the Ohio chapter of the Sierra Club. She has organized the new initiative, Beyond Dirty Fuels. Welcome to the show, Cheryl.
Thanks, Ann. I'm really happy to be here today. Thanks for the invitation.
You bet. And by phone, we welcome petroleum geologist and Ohio regional director for the Independent Petroleum Association of America, David Hill. Welcome to the show, David.
Thank you. Thank you very much, and thanks for having me.
Natural gas production, as I said, in portions of Ohio, Pennsylvania, and West Virginia, known as the Shale Crescent, exceeded total production in Texas. It's the first time in 100 years. How big of a deal is that?
Well, and if I would talk to that, it's huge. As Ohio, West Virginia, and Pennsylvania, now known as the Shale Crescent, those states combined in December of 2017 produced 831 BCF of gas, as opposed to Texas that was 703. As you said, it's been the first time in 100 years this region, the Mid-Ohio Valley, the tri-state area, our production exceeded Texas. Heretofore, no one even thought about natural gas production coming out of Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
But because of the advent of horizontal drilling combined with our Utica and Marcellus shales, we have unlocked or broken the code on how to release trillions of cubic feet of gas that will last literally for decades.
Right. I wanted to ask you about what the expectation is of how long this is going to last. As you know, the region has Ben, we talked about it in the other segment. Both, it's a double-edged sword when you have these vast natural resources. The coal companies came in and pretty much stripped the region of the coal and are leaving, without leaving the region much of an infrastructure, much of an educated workforce, much of anything. Is this different, or could this be the same?
No, I think this will be vastly different than the coal industry. I don't want to speak ill of my brethren in the coal industry, mm-hmm. but in many cases, particularly in West Virginia, the coal companies own the minerals and the surface, and landowners receive nothing for that. But in Ohio, it's much different, and in the natural gas, it's often very different. The landowners will reap a royalty for that natural gas coming off of their property. And in the oil and gas industry, we also pay a lot of taxes. We pay a severance fee. That's a per barrel and per MCF fee that comes when we remove things.
Right.
We pay an ad valorem tax.
Not as high as the Governor Kasich would like to see it, not even close as to what it was in places like Texas.
Yes, it's one of the lowest in the country.
And I'd love to speak to that because in the Ohio Revised Code, the severance tax is for gravel, for coal, for all different kind of aggregates.
Mm-hmm.
And the severance tax, and I would encourage your readers to look it up, the severance tax is designed to pay for the regulatory body to oversee them. That's what the severance tax is. The severance tax was never meant to go into a general fund to fund other projects. So we pay those taxes. We pay good wages, so we have payroll taxes. The ad valorem tax, 70% of that goes back to the local school district in which the wells are drilled. So we need an educated workforce, like right here where I'm in, calling you from Cambridge, Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
We have Zane State University. We're training these young people to work in our industry. We're heretofore, you know, they might have to go to New York State or California or somewhere else to get a good-paying job. Now, because we have this great university system in Ohio, we can train these workers. We can train these young people for skilled jobs. Oftentimes, many of them are union jobs, so our kids and grandkids can stay right here in southeastern Ohio.
Cheryl John Cox, you know, David Hill said that the severance tax, what it's used for, and point taken, it's very different in Texas anyways. Texas depends on those taxes from the oil industry, you know, from that, but Ohio doesn't. Ohio has other forms of taxes and stuff like that. But as far as paying for the regulatory body to oversee, are you confident that that regulatory body is well-funded enough to oversee what is a burgeoning industry?
So in the policy forum, we call that agency capture, and that is when fees from an extractive resource industry go directly back to the agency that is has oversight of that industry. So in order for that oversight body, which in this case is the Ohio Department of Natural Resources, in order for that body to continue functioning at appropriate levels, they become dependent on those resources.
And what's wrong with that?
So the problem with that is that, we call it agency capture because if there's no taxes generated, then the agency's funding goes down and they have to lay people off. So then there is an incentive to approve every single permit that comes along, whether or not, you know, the landowners are resisting the opportunity. I was just speaking to a young woman this morning on my way in who was saying that, you know, they did not want to lease their land, but they really just felt like they didn't have a choice because Ohio, uses such barbaric practices as mandatory pooling, which means if they can get, you know, like 60% of a 160-acre drilling unit together, they can force the other landowners to lease their property or, in fact, actually go under their property.
And just take it.
So.
Okay. David, well, but first of all, you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. You just heard from Cheryl John Cox. She is the Beyond Dirty Fuels Initiative organizer for the Ohio chapter of Sierra Club. Also with us by phone is David Hill. He is a petroleum geologist, president of David Hill, Inc. in Byesville, Ohio. And he is also Ohio Regional Director of the Independent Petroleum Association of America. If you have a question or comment about this, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I spoke earlier on the show as well, David Hill, about the location of all of this is kind of primo. I mean, you've got the natural resources that you want, but you also have an incredible logistical location for transport and, of course, the Great Lake of Lake Erie.
No, you're exactly right. We have four things going for us in the Shale Crescent. One, as you mentioned, the inland waterways. Our inland waterways are the envy of the world with the lake,
the river.
Great Lake system, with the Ohio River, the Mississippi River, the intercoastal waterways. I'll give you one quick, real anecdotal thing. Some of the cracker plant in Beaver County, Pennsylvania.
And a cracker plant is what turns the gas into the raw material to make plastics. Yep,
that is correct. You crack the molecules and you separate out the ethane, which is then turned into ethylene. And then there's the polyethylene pellets. But so these large components are being built in Maine. And they're being put on ships and brought down the intercoastal waterway, up the Mississippi River, up the Ohio River to Pittsburgh, and then are transported to Beaver County, PA. We couldn't do that without this wonderful inland waterway system we have. We have a trained workforce. We also have the Ohio River for the cooling processes. And we're within, this is what is key and is exciting, is right here in the Shale Crescent area, we are within a day's drive of 70% of the United States population,
mm-hmm.
the very people that use the polyethylene pellets. So it's kind of silly to make those polyethylene pellets on the Gulf Coast of the United States and then ship them back up to the Northeast Corridor to make things. Let's take advantage of this wonderful gift we have called natural gas. Build the plants to make the polyethylene pellets, which is a feedstock for the plastics, and keep it right here. In a region that has been economically depressed now for decades. I mean, I've lived here for 50 years. I've seen poverty, and I want to fix that.
Cheryl John Cox, what's your approach? You're concerned about this just because we're talking about these natural waterways, just because these plants will be located within 70% of the nation's population. But isn't the demand driving this in the first place?
So no, it's not. It's not the demand driving it. And I would like to say to you that, you know, the industry has coined this region the Shale Crescent, but those folks that live and work along the Ohio River actually call it the Ohio River Valley. And that's where 5 million people actually get their water supply. And the concern, our main concern, is actually the impact on that water and the folks that get their drinking water from the Ohio River. We have 36 water intakes along the Ohio River, including the city of Cincinnati. And in 2014, we actually had a toxic spill. This is just an example. It was one of three toxic releases by the chemical industry in the Ohio River, where Freedom Industries leaked 30,000 gallons of methyl cyclohexamethanol, MCMH, that impacted 300,000 people's water supply and resulted in the city of Cincinnati and Louisville, Kentucky, having to shut off their water supply. It impacted 30,000 people directly, where they had to use bottled water for many, many days. And, you know, the CDC said there is no allowable level of this contaminant in the water.
David Hill, what about that? I mean, all the benefits that you noted, they're also, like a lot of things with this, is a double-edged sword. It could hurt a lot of people.
Well, thank you for allowing me to develop this point, because
sure.
In a modern society, we will never eliminate risk. You manage risk. And we should not act as if shipping methane up and down the Ohio River or any of those river systems. I would encourage people to go down by the Ohio River. It is a mainstream for commerce. There are all kinds of chemicals, all kinds of goods that are shipped up and down the Ohio every day, millions of tons per day of material. And so, you know, that's why we have, you know, we have the US EPA. We have the Ohio EPA. We have the Coast Guard. The regulatory bodies to monitor these activities are already in place, and they do a wonderful job. And we just have to manage risk. We can, you know, no is not an energy policy. We just can't say no, leave it in the ground.
But all right, David, let me push back. I mean, it's well publicized now that the guy in charge of the U.S. EPA is wants to deregulate, wants to take away a lot of regulations. Are you concerned at all that that could harm the legitimacy of your industry?
And the short answer to that is no, because if you would be in an industry that's regulated by the U.S. EPA mm-hmm. for many years, there were redundant policies, there were punitive policies, and in my mind, what I see him doing is rolling back regulations that really do nothing other than maybe make people feel good. And we need to focus on the real problems, and I see that's what the current U.S. EPA is doing.
So I'd like to respond to that. So the current administration is actually reducing the EPA's budget by more than a third, and that will directly impact...
It hasn't been approved by Congress yet,
that's
though.
Right, and that will be directly impact the funds that we have to administer the U.S. EPA. So Orsenko actually is being lobbied by manufacturing and chemical industry to stop... monitoring the Ohio River Valley for water quality. And I'd like to say that, you know, according to a show that you did back in 2016, WOSU broadcast, you know, there are over 600 toxic releases reported to the Ohio Valley, the Ohio River Valley Sanitation Administration every year. So 60 calls about toxic releases. And as we speak, the manufacturing and chemical industry is lobbying hard to get Orsenko to stop doing this monitoring. Your report also states that there has been significant improvement in the Ohio River Valley that has led to direct development to cities like Cincinnati just developed their waterfront. There are over 270 bass, are there 270 fishing tournaments on the Ohio River as a result of the improvements that have been happening at the along the Ohio River? And, you know, and can I just say that, you know, they say these regulations are onerous. At the same time that petrochemical was having a massive destruction in Houston, Texas, right? We had Hurricane Harvey, and we had massive destruction and massive releases. The American Chemistry Council was lobbying the Trump administration to not enforce additional safety requirements on the chemical industry. So these are not duplicative regulations. These are regulations that are there to keep our health and our environment. And, you know, when you do these economic analysis, when you talk about, you know, there's managing risk, what you're actually talking about is a calculation that determines how many kids can be poisoned to create one job or one new industry. That's what
you
we're
know,
talking about.
I'm offended by that comment. That is just not right. No one is going to damage or hurt any one child. Your side or my side does not have a lock on who loves our kids or grandkids the most.
Well, how would you describe risk?
It's not a debate. David Hill, we have the president and CEO of the Plastic Industry Association coming up next. I have to say goodbye to you. I appreciate your time.
Well, thank you very much.
Take care. That's Bye. David Hill. He is a local petroleum geologist, president of David Hill Inc. in Baysville, Ohio, and also regional director for the Independent Petroleum Association of America. Coming up, we'll continue our conversation about the what's known as the Shale Crescent now of Ohio, Pennsylvania, and West Virginia, and could become plastics belt of the United States in the next 10 or 20 years. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Natural gas production in portions of Ohio, Pennsylvania, and West Virginia this year exceeded total production in Texas. This is a big deal. The bounty has attracted the attention of the petrochemical industry, which creates the materials for plastics. We're talking about what that could mean for the region and Ohio. Still with us is Beyond Dirty Fuels initiative organizer for the Ohio chapter of the Sierra Club, Cheryl Johncox. Joining us now is president and CEO of the Plastics Industry Association. That's an organization based in Washington, D.C. It supports the entire plastics supply chain. Bill Carteau, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann.
We've been talking about the Rust Belt being eyed as a plastic belt. I wondered if you could talk about what the region lacks right now as far when it comes to attracting the petrochemical industry there. David Hill mentioned a little bit about, you know, ramping up educational prospects.
But it's a great question and one that I'm not sure that I can answer fully. But if you look at the plastics industry overall, and if you look at manufacturing, there is a job or a labor shortage, and especially in skilled trades. I spoke at the Chamber of Commerce in Pittsburgh a year ago, and that was certainly one of the main things that we actually talked about. But if you look at that region as a whole, it's actually been quite positive for the plastics industry, you know, over the years. West Virginia is certainly home to a lot of plastics manufacturing jobs and supports directly almost 5,320 people. The plastics-dependent industries in West Virginia, 218,000. Ohio is the second largest plastics-producing state in the country today, directly employs over 75,000 folks, and plastics-dependent jobs in Ohio, 1.7. So I would say that overall the biggest issue, and this is one nationwide for the industry, is the lack of skilled workers and entry-level workers overall looking at manufacturing.
It took about 60 years for the petrochemical industry to ramp up to the hub it is today in the Gulf. How can you, I mean, is that timeline the same sort of timeline we're looking at for the shale crescent?
No, I don't think at all. With the Marcellus Shale and everything in the area, and one of the speakers you had on a little while ago talking about wet gas and stuff, and ethane, I don't think it's going to take that long because the heart of the plastics industry is in the Midwest anyway, and with the new cracker that Shell is putting in, I think that there's just huge opportunities already there in that area. And I absolutely do not believe that it's going to take the 60 years. Technology is moving so fast in our industry and new developments, and I think that that's going to continue to push things in that area.
Are you confident, though, that the regulatory arm of our governments, whether it's state or federal, is able to keep up with the speed at which the technology is developing? Can they regulate an industry that's changing so fast?
The shale gas and fracking has been around for decades, and this isn't something new, and I think the speed of which we're doing and the technology, I think that absolutely the EPA, the government, and local governments can absolutely regulate that. I was actually with the Undersecretary of Energy 2 days ago, and we actually were having that conversation, and I think, you know, the federal government has allowed the states to regulate this, and I think the states are very interested in making sure that what we're doing is very safe. And again, the technology has been around for decades. This isn't something that's just been developed over the last few years.
Cheryl Johncox, as Bill Carteau just said, Ohio is the second largest producer of plastics, employs about 75,000 people in that business, and also in plastics-dependent industries, about 1.7 million people. So it's already here, plastics development, plastics production. What do we know about that informs you from where you sit as an environmentalist for the the Sierra Club.
Well, I have to say that, you know, we're talking about an ethane storage facility that is under permit review right now that will actually store liquid ethane under the Ohio River. And, you know, they're doing this at a location where they can they could withdraw as much as 1 billion gallons per day from the Ohio River. And this is just one of several storage sites that they have in mind. The Shell ethane cracker that was just referred to actually will emit about three quarters the amount of carbon dioxide as the Killen coal-fired power plant, as well as, you know, some other toxics, you know, nitrous oxide, carbon monoxide, fine particulate matter, we know, which is one of the leading causes of heart disease. And so we're in an area in Ohio that already is in non-attainment for air quality. So Ohio and Texas go back and forth every year about who has the worst air quality in the United States. And so we're taking a region where, specifically the Ohio River Valley, where we have a lot of hills and valleys.
Where things get trapped.
They do. These toxins get trapped down into these valleys. And then folks that are, you know, you know, low income may not have the ability to leave the area are in fact trapped. And I would also say that, you know, the folks, you know, if you look at what's going on in Louisiana and in Houston, Texas, you ask the folks that live right down there where industry is, if they're seeing the benefits. And in fact, what they're seeing is they're seeing their insurance premiums go up and their health declining at a rapid rate. So I'm not disputing the fact that we have the plastics industry here now. Mm-hmm. What we're saying is that this is a bad idea for the river that is coming back to life and bringing us huge economic boom, and that there are alternatives for the Appalachian region of Ohio.
Okay. Bill Carteau, I wanted to ask you about that, what we've learned from the increased incidence of weather down in the coast region, down in Texas. We're getting it in Ohio as well. How is the industry adapting to the climate change and the changes to come in our weather? More violent storms, more storms, that kind of a thing.
And unfortunately, I don't know that I can answer that question. You know, it's certainly not something that I'm an expert on at all.
Mm-hmm. Is it something the industry is concerned about, though?
You know, I would say that the industry overall is, you know, very concerned about, you know, the health and well-being of, you know, every human being. And, you know, we follow regulations and we help set regulations. We as a association have been working with the Food and Drug Administration for 60 years on, you know, regulations surrounding plastic packaging materials. You know, I have children, I have grandchildren, and I certainly don't want to see anything happen to them. So, we are actively engaged as an industry on a day-to-day basis, you know, working with the regulators, not only here in Washington, D.C., but around the country, making sure that our plants are safe.
Why a storage facility, for instance, underneath the Ohio River, though, for ethane?
You know, this is actually the first that I've heard that there is an ethane storage facility.
Well, plans
so I really
for
can't
it.
Answer that question.
Okay. All right. How, when you look at the, what, how many, I wanted to talk in general, what you understand about how many jobs we're talking here.
I'm not 100% sure what, you know, the new crackers facility, how many jobs, you know, that they're actually talking about. But when you look at the amount of plastic processing that's already, you know, in that area. And I didn't mention earlier Pennsylvania, mm-hmm. You know, which is obviously right in the heart. There's already almost 48,000 people employed in the industry. Pennsylvania ranks seventh overall in the country, and 1.7 million jobs are dependent on plastic. I think having the amount of plastic material coming out of that plant in the next few years, you know, is going to create hundreds, if not thousands, of manufacturing jobs in that area. And then if you look at the dependent industries and you look at, you know, the trucking and the rail and construction jobs, it's obviously going to go into the thousands when you put all of that together, just looking at where the industry has come from already in those areas.
Cheryl John Cox?
Yes. So there will be actually 600 permanent jobs from that one cracker plant, which is nothing, you know, to flick your nose at. But I do have to say that, you know, these are, there are other job prospects in the region. And just for instance, comparison, the Sierra Club actually recently worked with American Electric Power on shutting down some of their coal-fired power plants. And as part of that, negotiation, they are going to develop 400 megawatts of solar power that gives preferential treatment to Appalachia. We want those solar arrays to be sited in Appalachia. And as part of that, they also want to create a permanent manufacturing hub in the region to retrain and develop the components. Now, that isn't, you know, that settlement isn't in place, but AEP is taking bids. They haven't started that project yet, but AEP has received several bids on that project. So we're working with energy companies to help folks get jobs where they don't have to choose between, okay, am I going to put my family's health at risk, or can I put food on the table? And these are the type of choices that, unfortunately, people in the Ohio River Valley have had to make for almost 100 years. And it's time for us to move on. It's time for the folks there to create their own vision of what they would like in the Ohio River Valley.
Bill Carteau, a criticism of the fracking industry is that it promised a lot of jobs, and it has brought a lot of jobs, but it's also imported a lot of workers from other states to do those jobs. Why should Ohioans, Pennsylvanians, West Virginians believe that they're going to get those jobs when these plants open up? Bill Carteau?
Sorry, when you look at plastics manufacturing, you know, overall, and you look at a plastics manufacturing plant that actually processes the pellets that will be made at that facility into plastic products, you know, there's a lot of entry-level positions as well as skilled trades with engineers and things.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there are great universities and colleges in the Ohio River Valley that will benefit from that. And, you know, rather than having, you know, like Ohio has been, you know, losing population and people have been moving out of the state,
right,
there will be new opportunities for those folks in the state so they don't have to move. And I think this comes back to the comment I made earlier with the overall worker shortage in manufacturing. There's almost 400,000 open manufacturing jobs around the country today. And, you know, plastics is no exception. So people have had to move to be able to take some of those jobs. You know, I want to go back and just talk briefly about the fact that, you know, the United States has really become energy independent over the last few years. And we have more natural gas in this country than Saudi Arabia does oil. And being able to take advantage of where that natural gas is in the Marcellus Shale and convert that into modern, clean, safe facilities like Shell is building in that area, you know, has huge opportunities for the people in that area. You know, I think, you know, the comments about, you know, people having to make a decision whether or not they're going to work in a safe environment, that's not what our industry is all about. And maybe 100 years ago, I mean, if you look at manufacturing in this country overall 100 years ago, it has changed dramatically. And the new facilities that are going in, whether it be in the Gulf or along the Ohio River Valley, you know, meet all of the requirements, safer than most facilities anywhere else in the world. And I don't think people have to make that choice.
Cheryl John Cox, I'll let you have the last word. We have about 30 seconds.
Thanks, Ian. You know, there are some great YouTube videos about the communities that live along these petrochemical corridors in Houston and, you know, in Louisiana. I'd invite folks to take a look at some of that information, and they can decide for themselves who's benefiting from the expansion of these processes.
Cheryl John Cox, Beyond Dirty Fuels initiative organizer of the Ohio chapter of the Sierra Club. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And also William Carteau, president and CEO of the Plastic Industry Association. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Ann.
That's it. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.